Hear me, are you recording?
I have little squiggles across the screen.
Hello. Well, it's being recorded, but there's no sound coming out of. Maybe they're supposed to turn this on somehow. Are they supposed to come?
Yeah, they're coming. They were right around the corner.
Okay.
So I have a feeling they're coming back.
Okay. No problem.
To get this information, because last year they just passed a, I don't remember if it was a policy at their hospital, we passed a resolution at the State Nurses Association, that the State Nurses Association adopt the policy that all healthcare providers needed to be immunized before the first of the flu season, which, you know, we're always a little behind in Louisiana, so. That obviously had never been done before, so.
Oh, well, it's ahead of Florida, so. Still ahead of Florida. So
Jared's going to be all excited to see somebody else, because he's all about it.
Oh, yes.
He also works in a pediatric clinic.
Yes.
So he's like, you know, you get so at risk to everything. Did I do that right? I did. I was freaking out.
You know.
Well, no, I knew I was supposed to do that, but then.
But then I have no sound. I mean, people can't. So where are you from? Okay, and are you interested in influenza? Sorta.
I work in oncology.
Oh,
you know,
okay, that's cool. We just didn't know
the hospital had, you know, of course, all the hospitals in that area adopted that all healthcare personnel.
Great. Wonderful. Yeah, because say, now is it recommendation? Is it mandate?
Mandate.
Oh, it's mandate. Really? Did y'all get any pushback?
You can some people could sign a waiver, but they had to show documentation from their primary care. I mean, you had to jump through some hoops in order to waiver it.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
because that's there is a national summit, influenza summit, every year that's sponsored by CDC and AMA. And it's a group of. I'm sorry. Oh, I can plug. Oh, wonderful. And it's all the interested people who are interested in influenza would get together and we talk about policies and availability of vaccine, what's good, what's bad, and all that stuff. And we've been talking about mandating, and many places have mandated, and some have pushbacks, but
check
some
two.
Are quite successful.
Check one, check two, one, two, one, two. Check one, two, one, two.
I'll be right back to make sure.
Okay. Well, I probably shouldn't unplug anything. No, there's not.
Are those not an extra plug?
No. Yeah, he'll tell me
where to plug
in. There may be. Here are plugs. Yes. Well, I don't really need to, but sometimes if you're not plugged in, it will dim. It will dim, and you don't want to dim in the middle of a presentation. And I have my plug-in. Here's my little thingy. know you're funny. Oh, I got it. Okay. Yeah, I should.
We'll see how they claim
it. Yes, it should. I like, I like the view because then I get to view my next slide.
Oh, your notes?
Yes, and
so
see?
Know, we can do that as well on PC.
Yeah, but it has a timer too. Well, not just notes. It's the next page.
You're fine. You're the last presentation.
Yes. Oh, great.
One less thing I have to carry out.
Good.
See, it works. It's a win-win for everybody.
Yep.
Right. Save me 30 seconds on my Friday.
Cool.
Yay.
When you're in healthcare, every 30 seconds counts, huh?
Yeah.
Every 30 seconds counts.
Oh, yeah, that's my water. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's all taped up. And I got the
chair. Oh, okay.
But you're okay.
Mm.
Good?
What about the mic
with sound? He said we won't hear it over here, but it is definitely recording. He checked it.
Oh, okay. Is there a, well, sometimes I wonder if we have such a small audience.
I know you have to scoot out.
A remote or?
Presentation remote?
Yeah, just advancing it or?
No.
That's okay. Don't worry.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It is all right. I can adapt. It's all good. Okay,
no,
let's.
In the order of starting on time, because I'm one of those stickers that like to start on time so we can finish on time. We've got other places to go. Thank you. Oh, I have to be over here. Hey, Lana. Even for the introduction, see, this is the first one I've done all week.
So they know which one it is.
Hi. Welcome to the afternoon session. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to introduce our speaker is Dr. Mae Kung, and she's going to, from the University of Florida. Excuse me, Florida State.
Florida
too
State.
Too many
I
colleges.
from U.S.
Excuse me. Got to be straight with the Florida State University business. All those colors. But the Tigers are better anyway, so it's okay. It's okay. Dr. Kung is going to be speaking to us today on a quality improvement project to increase influenza vaccination in healthcare personnel at a university health center. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Kung.
Well, thank you. Well, since she did such a great job, and we know we're in the right room about influenza vaccination, we are good. And so I am a full-time faculty now at Florida State University, and I also practice in a clinic called Havana Health and Wellness Center. And this presentation has to do with my DMP project, and the aim is to increase vaccination. And I'd like to know, like, where are you a DMP? Are you a student? Are you a faculty? You're a DMP student.
I'm an oncology nurse practitioner.
Uh-huh. Great. And now, do you have a project already picked out and you know what you're going to do? Okay.
I'm mostly focusing on oncology, on barriers to care, and identifying distress, using the distress screening tool as an implementation project for our cancer center.
Okay. Then I will, because you know, number one with teaching is know your audience. And I want to be able to tailor to what you need. And since both of you are DMPs, then I probably don't need to go through the process of doing this project to share, because you already know. You want to know? Okay.
I'm a student too.
Okay, all right.
I'm a student too.
All right. And then so I can tell you. Yeah, and then I can walk you through my DMP project and to know what the process were. You know, sometimes everything takes a little longer than expected and what happened along the way. So, okay, then I will cover both. So what I'm going to do is cover a little bit of the clinical aspects of it, which is an overview of influenza. And then we're going to talk about the importance of influenza vaccination to set the stage for why I did the project I did. And here are the objectives, and I'll let you go ahead and read that. As you know, influenza causes significant morbidity and mortality every year, and influenza and pneumonia has been the eighth leading cause of death in this country for a long time. And influenza alone causes about over 200,000 hospitalizations every year, and responsible for up to 49,000 deaths and costs about $37.5 billion a year. And as we know that the symptoms of influenza is that sudden onset of fever, headaches, and you feel like a mat truck's run over you, and you feel tired, you may have a cough, a runny nose, and sore throat. Some people may have some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and some people may not. And also note that some people have atypical symptoms, may not run fever. Some people may not even show much of a symptom. And how is it transmitted? By respiratory droplets, through coughing, sneezing, or touching a contaminated surface, and then you touch your nose and touch your mouth, and that's how you can get it. And you can transmit it from the day before you get sick. That's when you start shedding viruses. And for adults, the shedding continues for 3 to 5 days. Therefore, if you are trying to get a specimen to test them if they have influenza, you want to do it within the shedding period. And for kids, it's a little longer. That lasts about 10 days or more. And for immunocompromised people, it's even longer. Can be weeks or months. When you get the live attenuated influenza vaccine, which is the flu mist, you can shed some viruses. However, unless you work with severely immunocompromised patients, such as cancer and transplant patients, unless you work with those patients, you don't really have to worry too much. But if you do work with those populations, then you want to refrain from having contacts with them for a week afterwards. And in 1999, there was a very well-known randomized prospective double-blind control study that ran for 3 years and at two hospitals. They found 7 to 26% of those clinicians, healthcare providers, who did not receive a vaccine had serologic evidence of infection, influenza infection. And when they asked them, do you remember ever having symptoms? And they 42% of them said no. And there was another survey that surveyed nurses and in a large hospital with 513 people completed the survey. And nearly 80% of the nurses who responded said, this past year, I had some influenza-like illnesses. But guess what? We continue to go to work, right? How many have done that? I know I have. And 82% of them went to work when they were ill. And so from the time that you are exposed until the time that you develop symptoms, that's the incubational period, that's about 1 to 7 days, on average of 2 days. And there are three different types of influenza viruses, type A, B, and C. A is the most virulent. And, you know, we often wonder, what's H1N1, H3N2, H5N1? whatever. You know, it's like alphabet soup. And why are they named this way? That's because of the surface protein of the virus of type A. And there are hemagglutinins. There are about 16 types out there. And these listed affect humans and their neuraminidase, H1N2, that affect human. And there are also strains of these types, like H1N1 for the seasonal influenza was different than in 2008, was different than the 2009 H1N1 because that caused the epidemic, that was a novel virus that caused huge problems in 2009. And the avian flu is H5N1. Now type B is less virulent, and you might have heard of the Yamagata or the Victoria lineages. And type C, it rarely causes any significant problem. And this slide talks about the antiviral resistance of these to antiviral medications. And I don't know if you recall, back about 2005, 2006, through 2008, seemed like they kept changing their minds about what we should use. One year they said to use Simatril and Flumidine, and one year they said don't use them and use Tamiflu, and next year they changed their minds. And it was just like, what are you doing? And then realized, read a little bit more, and there were a lot of resistance. These viruses are very good at antigenic drifts or shifts, and then they mutate and they develop resistance. And there are two classes of drugs that we use to treat. One is adamantanes. They're like Simatril and Flumidine, and they're M2 channel inhibitors. What they do is it prevents the virus from attaching to the cell and blocks that M2 channel so they can't get in. And because it's not indicated to treat influenza type B because type B doesn't have the M2 channel. So it's not indicated to treat type influenza B. And there's the neuraminidase inhibitor that we hear about, Tamiflu and Relenza. And what they do is it prevents the viruses from being released from the infected cells. And if you look at this slide, in 2008 to 2009 season, the seasonal H1N1 was resistant to Tamiflu, but susceptible to these two. And then in the same year, there was the H3N2 virus. They were susceptible to the neuraminidase, but they were resistant to the adamantanes. And I remember that season in Relenza was pretty new. It was in short supply. And if we didn't know what type, if it was H1N1 or H3N2, we either had to treat them with Relenza or else we had to treat them with a combination of Tamiflu and either Simatril or Flumidine. But the good thing is, since 2009, the predominant circulating strains have been susceptible to either Tamiflu or Relenza, and including the influenza type Bs. And we shouldn't be using the Simatril or Flumidine because majority have been resistant to these drugs. Now, how do you know if you don't test? And one tool we can rely on is the CDC. FluView, they do surveillance and they post it on their website. I'll show you a few slides about what kinds of information they report. For this slide, you can see it started in 2011, week 40. Week one is January 1st. Week 52 is last week in December. And this started in 2011, week 40, and ended in 2012, week 26, was June 30th. And you can tell the number of B cases, that's in green, the yellow ones that tested positive for type A, but they were not subtyped. And then you can also tell that they are the the H3s. H3s and 2s, and then there are the H1N1, which is has been predominantly the 2009 H1N1s. And this black line shows you the percent that they were tested positive, percent of specimens that were tested positive. This slide shows you the national trend as to the number of cases. And this was collected at the end of May 19th. Therefore, the activities were pretty not very significant. Now, this is another data that they collect, which is to look at pneumonia influenza mortality. And back in 2007, 2008, there was a significant jump in resistance to the Tamiflu, and probably other reasons too that caused this. But more than 55,000 people died that year. And also in 2009, you could see there was a spike in the death from pneumonia and influenza. They also track the number of pediatric deaths. And as you can tell, 2009, a significant jump in the pediatric deaths. They track percent of visits for ILI illnesses. And again, in 2009, there was this huge jump, and almost 8% of visits were related to influenza-like illnesses. Now, this slide is put in here. Given the time constraint, the purpose for this slide here is to show that just because we have ways of testing for influenza, but that doesn't really always very effective way to help us guide treatment, because cultures take a lot longer. As you know, if we want to start antivirals, we should start within 48 hours. That patients will get the best benefit from it. However, there are exceptions. People in the hospital, you want to go ahead and start them anyway if you pass that 48 hours. But also, they are not always accessible like the RT-PCRs. And if you have a new strain, the test may not be available, just like the H1N1, 2009 H1N1s. They could test if it was A or it was a B, but they couldn't quite differentiate if it was H1N1 when it first started. And there are the rapid tests. They are fast, but they're not very sensitive. They're very specific. And also with rapid tests, depending on what type of test you have, some test for A only, some types only test for A and B. But none of these tests can tell you if it is a H1N1 or if it's a H3N2 or the subtypes of these viruses. And just one word about rapid tests is if you have a positive test, you can say, aha, this patient has influenza, like a pregnancy test. But if you have a negative test, it does not rule out that this patient does not have influenza. Therefore, clinical judgment is important. And therefore, flu vaccine is considered the safest, the most effective way to prevent influenza. However, it does require vaccination every single year. And of course, it prevents transmission to patients, our coworkers, our families. And every year, WHO, FDA, that's World Health Organization, FDA and CDC get together, and some other organization, they predict what three strains of viruses are most likely to cause the most problem for the coming season. So they have, it's a prediction. And it's not always very accurate, but they try their best, I'm sure. And so they pick two strains of A and one strain of B, and they formulate the next year's vaccine. And this year, they started working on a quadrivalent vaccine with two A's and two B's. And initially, they thought it might be available, but they could. It's not available yet, but it's probably coming in the future. Once you receive the vaccine, it takes about 2 weeks for it to become effective. And as far as effectiveness of the flu vaccine, it depends on your patient's or the person's immune system. If you have a healthy immune system, it will be more effective. But if you're not, then it may be less effective. And also, in a season, the vaccine, if it's well matched, if the prediction was very good, then it's more effective. But if the prediction wasn't very good, not well matched, then it's not as effective. But no matter what, when it's well matched, it's 50 to 90% effective for healthy adults less than 65. But even when it's not as well matched, it still is 47 to 77% effective, and also prevents hospitalization and some other adverse outcomes of influenza. And for elderly people and people with chronic conditions, it prevents hospitalization and prevents death also. As far as benefits for healthcare personnel, why should we get vaccinated? Herd immunity, the more people who get vaccinated, then more people will be protected. And that's a term, I think you all understand herd immunity. And they have done studies about higher vaccination levels at a facility that does translate to lower risk of nosocomial flu infections. And also, those people who are vaccinated, healthcare providers are vaccinated, they're less likely to report ILIs, and then also less absenteeism. We like it when people show up to work. And there are also studies that show that for the number of vaccination, what it can prevent, like five vaccines can prevent one ILIs, and people who get vaccinated can prevent one death, and this is significant. Some people are concerned about side effects of flu vaccines. That's why they don't get it. But it is true that when you get flu shots, the flu shots can't give you the flu because they're dead viruses. And you may get some soreness of the injection site, a little swelling, fever, but those are usually mild, last for a day or two, and they subside. And with the flu mist, it's a live attenuated virus. It's a weakened virus. And the side effects, probably a little bit more than the flu vaccines. And you may have a little bit more runny nose, headache, sore throat, such. And kids, these are star ones, are a little more common in kids. Now this year, it came out with the intradermal flu vaccine, and I don't know if you have heard of, yes. And I was trying to get a picture, but you can't even see the needle. The needle is only 1.5 millimeter in size, and that's 0.06 inches. Think about normal needles, 3/4 of an inch, an inch and a half, and this one is 0.06. And it has some smaller doses of antigen by 40% less. It doesn't have thimerosal, so therefore people who are concerned about autism, and then they don't have to worry about that. And side effects are also mild. There are Fluzone high doses that were approved in 2009. It contains a lot more antigen than the regular flu shots. They are indicated for older people age over 65 because they found that they don't respond to the flu shots as well. Therefore, we wanted them to have a little bit more to boost their immunity. who should not receive a vaccine? Those people who are allergic to chicken eggs, they have severe reaction to influenza vaccines. And those people had Guillain-Barre's that developed Guillain-Barre's within 6 weeks of getting a vaccine. And kids, actually, there is a universal vaccination recommendation since 2010. Anybody who is over 6 months should get a vaccine. And therefore, who shouldn't get it? People who are less than 6 months old. And those people with severe symptoms, a fever, then they probably shouldn't take it right there and then. But those people with just a mild fever, low-grade fever, then it's fine for them to do. What about you here? But I got really sick after I got my vaccine. Oh, why? There's several possibilities. They could have been exposed to flu viruses before they got the vaccine or within that two-week period. Therefore, they develop symptoms. They also can be sick from non-flu viruses, or they could be exposed to a flu virus that's not covered in the vaccine. And there are also those people who don't develop immunity after they get the vaccine also. So why do we want to receive vaccine? All of these reasons that I covered, and I won't read the slide to you. And these are some of the national and worldwide experts and organizations such as World Health Organization, CDC, ACIP, which is Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and along with professional organizations, AMA, ANA, the Joint Commission, they all recommend all healthcare providers to be vaccinated for influenza vaccine. So what is the definition of healthcare personnel then? It is everybody, not just the nurses and physicians, allied health. It also includes clerks, environmental care staff, business staff, everybody. That includes everybody. So looking at this slide, you can see this is a slide that shows you what has our influenza vaccination rate been. And there are several different categories. And let's focus on the red one, which is healthcare personnel. In 1995 or so, it was around 30%. It gradually went up to about 40%. And then we had a season of shortage vaccine. Therefore, it dropped significantly. And finally, in 2008, it went up almost to 50%. And after 2008, it's been a little bit better, 52.9. And the Healthy People 2010 objective was to receive a vaccine. The rate is 60%. So I am, so in 2009, 2010, we did meet that goal, but I think we had a little help from the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. That's why we hit it, but I could be wrong. And now the new recommendation for the Healthy People 2020 is 90%. And in 2010-11 season, we had almost a 64% vaccination rate. So we're coming along, but still not great. And another reason for vaccination is because of regulation. Joint Commission, if you're from an accredited facility, then Joint Commission requires all critical care access hospitals, hospital and long-term care accredited program to provide influenza vaccine to everybody, all staff, volunteers, independent licensed practitioners. And the Center for Medicare and Medicaid also regulating that to make healthcare personnel vaccination rate a mandatory reporting item to demonstrate quality. And if you fail to report, you can have a 2% reduction in your reimbursement rate. Therefore, all facilities should be looking at healthcare provider, healthcare personnel, vaccination policies, and try to improve that rate. And this was my DMP project, and I graduated in 2010, and it from University of Florida. That's a picture of our nursing school. The setting for my project was a state university student health center, and we employed about 115 employees and serve a student population of about 41,000 people. And we have about 78,000 visits every year. Our health center has been a champion in advocating for staff and for students to be vaccinated. In 2000, we started our first campus-wide campaign, and we would go out to various locations on campus, dorms and colleges, and just give vaccine and to staff. And if you are a health center staff, you get it for free, and students got vaccines for free also. And the purpose for my study was to increase the vaccination rate. But at the time, we didn't even know what was our vaccination rate. Therefore, we had a lot of questions. We wanted to get a baseline of vaccination rate, and we want to find out in our facility what caused people to want to get a vaccine and what caused people not wanting to get a vaccine. And then once we find out, then what kinds of intervention are we going to implement to try to increase that rate? And once we implement it, we want to measure outcomes, right? Therefore, we want to assess how effective were our interventions. And of course, we had to have our PICO statement. PICO problems were the questions that I listed earlier, and also we wanted to increase the vaccination rate, and we want to measure our rates. And our intervention was actually, I designed a survey, a pre-survey, and then we have to determine what are some of the interventions that were good. And then I designed a post-intervention survey. And so it's a pre and post survey design. And therefore, comparison, we want to compare before the intervention and what happened after the intervention to the outcome measures. The endpoints were that what were the influenza vaccination rate for healthcare personnel, and how effective were those interventions. And the method was the target population included paid all the employees between age of 18 to 64. It was cross-sectional descriptive design. And the pre-intervention survey was implemented in the spring semester of 2009. And of course, we had to get IRBs. So I got two IRB approvals for my project. One for the university I was attending, and another one for the university that this project was in. And the survey was administered May 1st to June 1st, 2009 as a baseline. Once I administered that survey, I had to analyze the data. And then once the data was analyzed, then we had to plan interventions. And once intervention was planned, that I recommend something, I had to present to the administrators, because most of these interventions require time or money, resources, and changes in policy, so they had to approve them. And so that took me to about August of 2009. And so we implemented some interventions in the fall of 2010. Then, post-intervention survey, we had to modify it because I didn't know when I first submitted the IRB, I didn't know what kinds of intervention we were going to do. And also, there were other things that came up. So I needed to apply for addendums for the IRB to be approved because I changed some elements of my study. And the second survey was administered between January and February 2010. After that, data analysis again, and then we have to present the data to everybody. So, survey instrument. How did I design the survey instrument? I did extensive literature review and found a couple of instruments that I liked. So I wrote to them, these people, and say, well, may I have permission to use or adapt your questions? And they were very helpful, and they both gave me permission. So I adapted my surveys based on theirs, and it included questions such as demographic, and I'll also assess their vaccination status. The year that I administered the survey, and also the year prior, because I wanted to compare what did they do the year before. I also included 19 variables that talked about what made them want to get a vaccine, and 21 barrier variables to see why they wouldn't want one, and also assessed knowledge and attitude, and post-survey included every question except that the influenza status were two different years, the following year. And then we also assessed the intervention effectiveness and the impact of 2009 H1N1 epidemic happened right in the middle of my study. I thought, well, I had to address it. And the pre-intervention demographic, I had a response rate of 78% because we had an annual training date. Everybody had to be there. It was a mandatory training. So I had a wonderful response rate. And most of my respondents were older, between age 45 to 64. They were Caucasian, female. Most of them were clinical staff, worked with patients. And they worked mostly over 30 hours a week, and had about half of them had at least 30 hours of direct patient contact per week. And we were very surprised that our vaccination rates were so high. The year of the survey was almost 76%. And before we did this, we thought our vaccination rate was only about 20%. It showed you how off we were. And this was higher than the national average. And all of the people who were vaccinated reported that they received a flu shot. And back then, we only had the flu shot and the flu mist, which is the nasal spray, available to us. And 96% of these people received a vaccine at work. These were the questions that I included. I'm not going to read to it, and you have access, read to you because you have access to these. Basically, what are some of the main reasons that would prompt you to receive a vaccine? And these were the top results. They want to protect themselves and their families. And they take it because the vaccines were free. And expert recommendations were very important. And the vaccine process had to be convenient. If it wasn't convenient, then it was harder for them to go to. They also wanted to protect their patients. And with this result, it showed how important providers' recommendations are. We are nurse practitioners, many of us. And if we make a recommendation to our patients that it's important for you to get vaccinated, it does carry some weight. And we also asked them, what are the main reasons that you personally might not get a flu vaccine? People were a lot more likely to pick why they would get one, but they were a lot less likely to tell us why they wouldn't get one. And the highest percentile that people checked was 22%, and most of the other ones not listed were less than 5% that people checked. And number one reason for people not getting a flu vaccine was concern about vaccine side effects. And or they think that they're not in the priority group and others need them more. And I'm healthy, so I don't need it. It's not required for me, so why get it? I'm too busy, I forgot, or I had a bad experience in the past. And some people cited shortage of vaccine as the reason. Now that we learn what made people want to get one and what why people don't want to get one, then I search for evidence-based practice. What are some of the effective interventions and strategies that will increase influenza vaccination rate? And these were recommendations from CDC, from ACIP, HCPAC, and they recommend these strategies to be implemented in combination. It's more effective that way. And as you know, level 1A evidence is more sound than a 2 or a 3 or 4. And the best evidence out there is to provide for the employers to provide flu vaccine to people, and also to make them free vaccines to give them out for free and to make them convenient. Education is important. We want to let them know the risks and benefits of vaccination. Monitoring flu vaccination uptake and declination is important, and let staff know what is our influenza rate now after 1 week or 2 months or whatever. And for those people who chose not to get a vaccine, then they do recommend having them sign a declination form. And they want for vaccination rate to use that as an indicator for healthcare quality and safety. So based on these recommendations and based on the pre-intervention results, we implemented 4 interventions. The first one was education, to target misconceptions, concern about side effects, to talk about why bad experience and stuff, and to let them know why it is needed. And so what we did was I recorded a PowerPoint presentation, and we put it on our internal intranet that's available for people to watch, and it was a voluntary exercise, and they watched it on their own time. Intervention 2 and 3 was, we always provided free vaccines to our staff. We continue to do so. But we did make the process more convenient. In the previous year, we had one allergy nurse or employee health nurse that we scheduled appointment with. And by the time we had to schedule an appointment, and then we go down there and she may be busy, and we had to leave our stations, leave our patients. At the same time, our patients are still waiting, schedule full. So we made it so that we have a mobile cart, and that's available on every single floor. That's available when our health center was open at all times. So people, when it had a moment, they can just pop in and say, give me a shot, and they get their shot, and they leave. And so we made it a lot more convenient for people to get vaccine. The last intervention we implemented was a declination form. I designed one, and we required people to sign this form if they did not get it at work, because some people received vaccines at their doctor's office or their primary care offices, and we would have no idea. And also, this gave us a better way to track our vaccination rate based on the declination forms. So we did the post-survey to assess what were the outcomes of our intervention. Our response demographics were nearly identical. except the response rate was a little lower, 53%, and a little bit older, 45 to 64, consists of 77% of the respondents. But the rest of them, variables, were nearly identical. And influenza rate went up for both pre-survey and post-survey, but there is a bigger jump with the post-survey. And the statistics here is, for the pre-survey, I used a chi-square because I had better numbers, and so chi-square was appropriate, but used the Fisher's exact test because I had less numbers. But both of them were significant. And again, 96% of the people received their influenza vaccine at work. And all of them received a flu shot, which is trivalent influenza vaccine. Facilitators, again, I put the pre-survey on the left here and the post-survey, almost identical. The top three were exactly the same. We want to protect ourselves. Free vaccine, it's recommended by experts, and they realize that absenteeism, we can reduce it by giving vaccines, and we also wanted to protect patients. That's the same as the pre-survey. Barrier-wise, also very, very similar. And concern about vaccine side effects continues to be the most common reason why they don't want to get a vaccine. Some people didn't like needles, still think that they don't need it, still are too busy, shortage of vaccine, and some people were concerned that vaccines weren't as effective. By the way, 80% of the respondents who completed the post-survey also participated in the pre-survey, so they're quite similar. I did not match the two groups, because we have attrition rates, people leave, and we hire new people, and all that. Discussion. My findings were consistent with literature. When I did the study, most of the literature out there had to do with vaccination rates in the long-term care or in the hospitals, or the reasons why they wouldn't take vaccines or why they take vaccines. Studies were conducted in hospitals or long-term care. I couldn't find any study that addressed college health populations. And as you know, college health populations are younger and they're healthier. Therefore, we as practitioners, we may respond differently. But the results, my results from this study are consistent with existing literature. And we looked at the interventions, how effective. I used a Likert scale from 1 being least effective to 5 being most effective. And respondents rated very highly with these two factors, free vaccine and convenient process, as being the most effective. Education and declination forms, effective, but not nearly. And correlation tests, these two, free vaccine, convenient process, they are correlated, statistically significant findings, and correlated with vaccine uptake. And the other two are not. Compared to existing literature again, it's consistent because concurrent multifaceted interventions are more effective than just single interventions. And that free and convenient vaccine and convenient process of getting vaccinated, again, are the most popular and most effective. Education, not necessarily ensure vaccine uptake. And in this study, I do have to specify that only half of the respondents said that they took the education intervention. And I would suggest to First of all, to make it face-to-face so people can ask questions, so that we can use the same language at the level where they need to communicate with people, answer their questions, answer their concerns. And also, it's important that they do it on work time rather than taking up their own lunch hour to listen to this recorded PowerPoint. Declination form, it's not predictive of vaccination rates, but those facilities that have adopted a declination form tend to have higher influenza rates. I put the slides in here because 2009 influenza, the H1N1 flu, happened in the middle of my study, and that was an unanticipated event and an extraneous variable. And one of my limitations is because this happened, it could have affected the vaccine uptake, making it higher because people were afraid of getting the influenza infection. And also, they might have felt more pressure to get one. But on another hand, people may be discouraged from getting a seasonal vaccine because usually there is only one vaccine, but that year there were two vaccines, the 2009 H1N1 and the seasonal. And because of this significant outbreak, resources were taken away from seasonal vaccine, the manufacturing of the seasonal vaccine, and diverted it to making the 2009 H1N1 vaccine. Therefore, it created a shortage of seasonal vaccine. Therefore, because of the shortage, some people may feel like, oh, I'm healthy anyway. I really want to reserve my vaccine for somebody who needs a little more. And there was a study of survey that found about 7% of the healthcare personnel named unavailability of vaccine as a reason for not receiving a vaccine. Another reason why people might not want a seasonal vaccine was because 2009 H1N1 was the predominant circulating virus for that season. And it was not covered in the seasonal influenza vaccine. Therefore, they might have felt, oh, I don't need one anyway because it won't cover me. I put in an extra question in the post-intervention. I asked people, how did the novel H1N1 flu affect my decision to receive one, not to receive one, or it didn't affect my decision? Surprisingly, 76% of the people stated that the 2009 H1N1 did not affect their decision to receive a flu vaccine. A limitation of the study, it was self-reported information, small sample size, especially the second survey, and it was a convenient sample, so it could have selection bias, and it was difficult to assess the true impact of the 2009 H1N1 pandemic on the outcomes. So in summary, influenza causes significant morbidity and mortality every year, and experts recommend all healthcare personnel to receive a vaccine. And the Healthy People 2020 goal for all healthcare providers is set at 90%. This was a QI project aimed to increase the vaccination uptake of healthcare providers. We found that the facilitators and the barriers for vaccination uptake were consistent with literature. And the most effective interventions were providing free vaccine and making the process convenient. And this QI project took a span of over 18 months. I was very happy it was done. And so future implication is make these vaccines free and available. How many of you may have ability to affect policy where you work? Yeah. So we, and you guys already implemented the mandate to be vaccinated and to make it free and available. And education, make it part of employees' works assignment. Face-to-face, we talked about that. Targeted for knowledge level of the participants. And we still need to understand what characteristics of employees are associated with vaccine update, vaccine uptake. In fact, that's my next manuscript that I have a draft for, that it's coming out. I did analyze the data, and some were interesting. And we may need to entertain a mandatory vaccine policy. And these are my references. And this presentation is based on these three manuscripts that were published. If you want references and to read them. And oh, by the way, this was written up as a manuscript, and it's been accepted by the Journal of the American Academy of Nurse Practitioners. So I'm really happy with that. And so, vaccinate against the flu. Do you have any questions?
There was one slide you had in there that it was something that for all the time that I've been a nurse, I didn't realize it, and I just wonder if other people realize it, that there are people who get it. I didn't realize that, I guess it's normal that any type of vaccination you have, somebody may not respond to it.
Right.
But what is the rate?
Yes. It's hard to say because it is depend on the person. See, the thing is, in order for you to do that study, you have to do a titer before, the serology before, and then you have to do a serology after. And how many people are willing to do that? And also, this is influenced by the age of the person, the immune status of this person. Does this person have a chronic illness, or is this person a healthy individual? Is this person 2 years old, or is this person 80 years old? And you have to do all these studies, and it's just not done. It's usually how they found out is you got a vaccine, you received the vaccine, but why are you sick? Mm-hmm. And then they might have drawn the titer and realize. And then you have to think about if they get sick, then do they get sick from the viral strain that was in the vaccine, or was it a different strain of virus? And you have to do titer, and you have to do cultures, RT-PCRs to identify exact strain of these viruses. And it gets really complicated. And I have not read any data to that effect. Yes.
My other concern now is that, you know, with the mandate, they're bringing out these vaccines and making them very convenient for the hospital staff. But they're starting them in the 1st of September. And people have this mindset that it's too early. I can't get it right now because I get it in October, middle of October. So that whole educational
exactly
thing, why has that reverted? Why has that changed?
Well, I'm not sure if they've done studies, but I just remember that of a number of years ago, they always say, 1st of October.
Yes.
1st of October to get vaccinated. And then the recommendation changed. It says you can go ahead and be vaccinated as soon as you receive that vaccine. And then I think that they probably have demonstrated that the protective effect lasts through the season. And that's what they've been recommending for at least the last 3 or 4 years.
But
just
still
get it.
There's lag of education with staff that says, no, I can't get it right now because it's only September.
Yeah.
You
Yeah, that was the other thing I thought about. Is like, if you, has anybody ever looked at the fact of the people that say, well, I'm not going to get the flu shot anymore because I got it last year and I still got the flu. Well, if they were already in that incubation period,
right,
then they're going to get it, and it has nothing to do with the shot. But if you don't have any data, then you can never disprove to the rest that it isn't because of the flu shot. It was because you were already had the sniffles before it started. And I would think maybe if you did it in September, because usually October is usually the first of the cooler weather. So if people are going to have the sniffles anyway, it's going to happen there. So I guess in my mind, it makes sense that you would back it up to September because you might have a healthier population so that you get more benefit.
Right. Now, think of this. Why was 2009 H1N1 so different or so special? Influenza viruses usually occur in the fall, winter. Yes, it was in the summer.
I shot a summer. I had to shut a camp down in the summer because half of my counselors tested positive. And it's like everybody was saying, you can't have the flu in June. And I'm like, that's where it is today.
Exactly. And it was so atypical because it happened in the warmer months rather than in the colder months. Therefore, it's almost like it doesn't matter so much anymore. It can occur any time. And if you have been following the news on influenza, there is another novel strain of swine flu that happened, that clustered in Indiana. It's a new variant. And they're not as sick. Last I heard, I don't think anybody died, but maybe there's been one or two deaths. There was an influenza summit call yesterday that I couldn't attend, or day before. Maybe it was yesterday, I can't remember. Anyway, and they've been reporting cases, and it happened to be infecting people who own pigs,
yes,
or exhibiting pigs, and these viruses are susceptible to Tamiflu, and I don't think anybody died yet from it. There have been a few hospitalizations, but they respond to Tamiflu. And this happened again when the weather was fairly warm. And then I still think that influenza vaccine is important because also 2009, it was atypical because normally, when you have influenza infections, affect the most morbidity mortality occurs in the very young and the very old. But that year, it hit people very young and the healthy population, the young adults, and not so much of the older adults because they think that they already had some immunity from a little different virus from years ago. Therefore, I think it's good to keep getting vaccinated. You just
maybe
never
we should
know.
Do it twice a year. Maybe we should do September and then revaccinate. You know, maybe it shouldn't just be seasonal.
I think I still think that it does protect you. Otherwise, they wouldn't make that recommendation. I don't know how long the protection will be, and also I don't know how well you respond because again, people respond differently based on your age, your immune status, and your chronic conditions, and all that. And where was I going? I can't remember. But anyway, I just think that it's a good idea. And in the last year, 2009 H1N1 vaccine was given 2010 and 11. It was the same vaccine. That was given again. And so people say, well, why do I need to get the same vaccine again the following year? But that was what they recommend. It was easier, probably, just tell people, just get vaccinated.
Well, thank you very much. We're on our time, and we want to get down to the last general session.
But yes.
Thank you so much. This is very informative.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
And I appreciate the process, too, for those of us who are students.
Yeah, it takes a long time. Everything takes a long time. Takes time.
But I'm all about the metro because we don't have that where I live. I'm sorry?
Do you want to go?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Well, what time do we need to go? I mean, are there certain hours that it's open?
I have no idea. I
don't
you know
what
time the
check
church
with,
opens.
Maybe check with the concierge.
Yeah.
I have to, because I'm kind of, because I'm the volunteer coordinator this
yeah.
year, I have some
oh,
little
you
things
have so
I have
many.
To go do downstairs.